old students here. John, you've known Catherine for a decade or more, haven't you? And Chuck and Steve, so you can keep me in check, make sure I'm not speaking heresy. It occurred to me in an earlier discussion about karma that what I'm going to say are the central teachings of Reverend Catherine Thanis are the teachings that I heard, are the teachings that resonated with me, and other people definitely have a completely different idea of what her central teachings are. And at least in the next month, we'll have a chance to look at this. I heard that on the next three Wednesday nights, we've got Beata and Kathy Toldy and Dana. So if they're going to talk about the central teachings of the Reverend Thanis, we might hear at least four versions of that, and we might get most of them in. So I'm basically going to extemporize here. I didn't prepare much for this, but I've got lots of feelings, you know, close to the surface, and hopefully they can be attached to some stories and some real teachings of Catherine as they tumble out. When I first came here 20 years ago, it was like a lot of us, I was dealing with the great matter, and the very first lecture I heard Catherine give on a Wednesday night was something about life and death. And I thought, my gosh, she must have been in my last therapy session. And but as I learned more about Buddhism over the next few years, I realized that Buddhism is about the great matter. And I heard lots of talks that sounded like my therapy from whoever was sitting up there. In those days, we just had one seat, so whoever was giving the talk sat here. And Catherine would move when there were guests. As a matter of fact, the very next week, so this my, it was a heady first few weeks. Catherine was first on Wednesday. The weekend, Ed Brown did a cooking workshop in town here as a fundraiser for the Zen Center. So I spent the day with Ed Brown on my, you know, fourth day of meeting Zen. And then the following week, Tigan gave a talk on his new book at the time, the one about... No, it was about not that one either. If I can think of one word, you'll all get it. Silent Illumination, whatever. What book was that about? Yeah, Cultivating the Empty Field. Is that right? And I didn't understand a word of what Tigan said. But I've gone back to listen to it Because we have everything on tape. We've got a whole library of Catherine, you know, 20 years of Catherine's talks. But I listened to Tigan's tape, and it was a very good lecture. And even though I just, what's this about? What's emptiness? What's, emptiness was so, sometimes in the morning here, there were just a couple of people. The Doan sat here. We didn't even have a jiko, a jisha. We had a candle on the Doan seat, and at time for service, the Doan would light the candle and light the incense, and Catherine would come over and take the incense from the Doan, because the altar was right here, and Doan was here, and bowing mat was there. So Catherine would just come around, and so the Doan was the Kokyo and the Jiko, Jisha, and we would hand her the incense, and she would open the Zendo. And in the first few months, I became both a morning Doan and took on a few evenings, because we only had one Doan. We only had Daigon, who was living in the house, and he was here every morning, at least when I was here. He was the Doan in the morning, and at some point he wanted to take a vacation, and he gathered people who he'd seen in the morning and said, would you be the Doan? Could I teach you the Doan? I think he had already trained a few evening Doans so that he didn't have to be here every evening. But that's how I got started, and I probably got caught by Zen and Buddhism, life and death, talking about life and death, before I got caught by Catherine. One thing that Catherine taught us lay people who came here from home and from work was that we could sit in our lives, no matter how busy we thought our lives were. She made us understand how central that was to practice, and to our bodies, not just to be doing something to be able to call ourselves Buddhists. If you call yourself Buddhist, you have to sit. That wasn't it. She was able to show us how important sitting still is to us bodies. And that it became then something that was important to put in our lives, no matter what we were doing. So we all knew early on that central to our experience as humans and to our experience as Zen students was this practice of sitting and calming the body. And she did it by her own example. She was here every morning. And like I say, sometimes just with the Doan, and sometimes with a half a dozen people in the room. But no matter what, she was here every morning. And that's how... she showed us that bodies can do this practice. And when we did this practice, we felt that this was an important experience for our bodies to have. I read someplace that there are some orthodox religions where it's important to study holy books and study the ethical writings of religious people and apply that to your life. But that at its core, Buddhism was an orthopractic religion where we have to do something, where we have to move our bodies, where we have to put our bodies into play. There's practices that are central to this religion. And that's what Catherine taught us by just being here every morning and just having a pile of books every Wednesday night for 20-some years. It was in our bodies that we, through our bodies, that we connected with Catherine. She put that vibration out and we picked it up because they were our vibrations. And I think that's how I started connecting with Catherine, was putting my body into this position. I think yesterday I made a comment to something that Kokyo said about there's something about Zen that forms communities. And maybe this is what I didn't want to just single out Zen. Maybe it's a spiritual phenomenon, but there's something about Zen that forms communities. And in my own life, you know, as I got to know the people sitting here, I knew that they were doing the same practice as I was. They were practicing sitting. They were you know, in their daily life, whether it be at work or at home or at school, they were practicing mindfulness. And when I saw these people, I wanted to be with them. I wanted to be with the people that you know, met their life with these bodies, with these practices. And that, for me, was a part of why community was also so important from the very beginning. The people were interesting because we were all kind of doing the same things. We were all interested in experiencing the world through these bodies and through these practices. And right there with us was Catherine at every opportunity. So this practice was central to her teaching. She told us that in the early days of sitting with Suzuki, Westerners would come talk to him about going to Japan to learn Zen, and how can they do that, and can Suzuki help them, you know, go learn real Zen in Japan. And Suzuki would just invite them to, well, why don't you, you know, we sit here every day. Why don't you come sit for a while? Why don't you come sit first? And that was very much Catherine's encouragement. Let's sit. In those days, you know, let me give you two opportunities a day to sit here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. We started Sesshin practice, and Catherine had been here about 3 years before I came, and I came in like a February, and the first Sesshin I did with it here was up at Jokoji, and it was either late in the spring or early in the summer, so I'd been here, you know, 3, 4, 5 months. And it was very much my experience that this was an early practice. Maybe she had done a few sesshins before. And it seemed like the women in Monterey, and the entire Monterey group was women in those days, except Robert. Robert and 4 or 5 women students. So, but it seemed like the students in Monterey had knew about sesshin. So Catherine and the Monterey students were in charge. We didn't even have anybody that knew how to be a tenzo. You know, you can be a cook. We had plenty of cooks, but there was certain foods, you know, types of foods and the three bowl business. We didn't even have anybody that was, you know, could really do that. So we used a Jokoji tenzo, and I don't know if we paid her or not. I mean, this could have been part of the expense of Jokoji was paying the cook, but the first sesshin we had the cook was from Jokoji, wasn't from our group. And Catherine did Orioki instruction. She actually did Orioki instruction for a lot of those first sesshins, but it was my experience that even though I mean, you were here before I came, but it seemed that my first sesshin was one of the earliest. That was sort of an early practice. So, and we went up there about every other time, and a real gift that Catherine had was this, you know, telling us how important this practice, this sitting practice was. I can remember at some point at Jokoji in those early times, I was sitting in a period of meditation and I heard a plane going over the top of us. And I was convinced that that plane was so lucky to be flying over the energy that we had created there at Jokoji, that those people don't even realize how lucky they are, that they're feeling good because we have made this universe, or at least the column of universe above Jokoji, a special place. That was how important she made this practice feel, that it wasn't just that we get a little calmness, a little bit of tranquility, a little rest, but we are saving all beings, and we really felt that. I think I heard that early on, that you might be coming here because you need a little rest, because it feels, because the garden is nice, because it's calm, you know, coming into the garden. But you're really saving all beings, and at least at that one of those early sesshins at Jokoji, I felt that. I really felt that. As I mentioned earlier, with learning the primacy of this meditation practice, We learned to listen to our bodies. I think in the West, our consciousness is slowly risen out of the lower parts of our body, and we spend a lot of our time and energy up in our heads. I know that's not a surprise to anybody. I think we've heard that before, but and maybe it's not just Westerners, maybe it's just with the rise of the industrial age and now the electronic and technologic age, we're right here in our heads so much that to actually start paying attention in meditation and in this posture to the information that our bodies are giving us was a real breakthrough. And I think that kept me coming back. I was learning. It was like meeting an old friend. It was like, you know, it was like going to your high school reunion and you know, meeting somebody that you hadn't seen in a long time. You know, like Kathy said, you know, hello stomach, you know, hello knees, hello back, hello feet, hello breath. So when we were encouraged to sit at Tekoji in those sesshins, it wasn't with, you know, sit still. It wasn't an admonition to sit still. It was, what can you learn about your body if you sit still? And can you meet the discomfort in your knee with curiosity? What's it telling you about your body? Can you sit with it just a little longer? It might have something more to tell you. There was this way that, you know, with that kind of conversation of curiosity, that I learned to sit in sesshin. Without it feeling like, you know, there was somebody, you know, Catherine was the only one that was facing outward, you know, so Catherine was the only one that could see if we were squirming or, you know, bringing our knees up. It wasn't that I was afraid that she would see that I was squirming, that I sat still. It was, she really instilled in me this curiosity, and lo and behold, I was fascinated by what my body was telling me. There was a certain trust. You know, this was a foreigner. Why should I trust anything it was telling me? But meeting it as an old friend, I was able to trust that I could sit there and listen, that it was really going to tell me something important. Like Johnny was talking about fear, you know. After a while, I stopped fearing that I was going to die in sesshin from the pain, and I could come right into it and into my body and listen to what it had to tell me. And it, like like my old high school friend. It wasn't going to hurt me. We were going to do this just like the old days when I could put my body anywhere. Catherine, I guess what I'm talking about now is that orthopraxis part, in that, you know, we are experiencing the teaching through our own bodies, and that Catherine was so strong at teaching us. In those first few years, it seemed like we were studying Buddha's sutra, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, for 2 years. You know, she taught for 6 weeks in the beginning of the year, beginning practice period, 6 weeks at the end of the year. She may have done a shorter one in the summer. She would do a series of two or three lectures all on a subject, you know, in her Wednesday nights. But we went through the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and the commentaries by Thich Nhat Hanh, his Transformation and Healing. We looked at that for at least 2 years, and that was a real foundation for me. And interestingly, we'd start the first week of the new series kind of reviewing what we talked about in the last series. And it was always the first foundation. It was always about breathing. We never got past breathing in 2 years. We did it really thoroughly, and actually breathing segued easily into the body. And so we would have homework assignments, you know, where we'd actually do mindfulness practices at home or at work. And you know, one of course that we've all heard of is, you know, can you take a breath or two when the phone rings before you pick it up, and just check in with your body, check in with your breath. Don't fix anything. She wasn't sort of saying that you should sit up straight at work or anything. There wasn't any special posture that you should have at work. It was just, you know, bring it on home. Can you use the phone as a mindfulness bell for bringing it on home? And what an eye-opener it was to start practicing at work. You know, I was, you know, easily sold on this place. Even before our remodel, this place was a little garden cottage, you know, in the middle of my busy life, with people who spoke softly and tried to get along. So I was hooked. But then I had this other life that at work and at home, that this was the refuge. So I was going from one pole to the other, you know, within 24 hours. And what an eye-opener it was for practice to start seeping in to my whole life. And it was, you know, every mindfulness book says, you know, use the telephone as a mindfulness bell. But it worked. And that's how it started seeping in to my life, and bringing practice into a place that I thought was just so far away. When you first seek practice, you think you are far from its environs. And lo and behold, I was close to it with every breath. And so that came right out of sitting here on Sunday nights, you know, in a circle with Catherine here. You know, everything was on the floor in those days because we didn't have tons. That practice came right out of these Sunday night classes. Another practice was, could we start using two hands? Can we pick up our books with two hands? And I've talked about this one over and over. Can we reach for the coffee mug in the cabinet with two hands? Which was, you know, can you use your whole body? Can you bring all of your energy to this movement? And just to do that, just to remember to do that, to sort of, you know, brings you right here back home and into your body, to just remember to do that and feel the weight of the cup and to set it down, and feel and listen for the sound of the cup hitting the counter. In the service we did at Catherine's bedside yesterday, people were addressing Catherine. Beth, who was over on this side of me, talked about the instructions Catherine gave her upon to clean the Dokusan room. Can you just bring attention to the work that you're doing in the Dokusan room? Not because it's a holy... Beth didn't say anything about because it's a holy place. Beth said, Catherine just asked me to use attention when I cleaned the Dokusan room. And that's what the experience is of reaching for the cup and placing it carefully on the counter, or being fully in your body and experiencing your breath before you pick up the phone. If you haven't done that, give it a whirl. What an experience is. The first words that come out of your mouth might be different when they come from your belly, rather than when they, you know, come from, you know, way up here. So mindfulness, you know, one of Buddha's core teachings, his first lecture on suffering and the Eightfold Path, was also something that I first heard, you know, coming from Catherine in the beginning of my practice. So I really feel, you know, just like it's one of the four, or it's the four foundations. I really felt that Catherine taught me the foundation of my practice that still is that reinforcer. I want to do it again and again because I have a pleasurable feeling, because I feel I'm my whole body. As a matter of fact, I feel like my body is bigger. I mean, one of the first days when in this sesshin, when we were grappling with the idea of reincarnation, I was sitting back there and my comment was, you know, I think I've experienced that consciousness, even what I call my consciousness, is bigger than the outlines of my body. So there might be something that's bigger than my body, that is with me every day, and that's kind of something that I experience when I reach with both hands for the cup. coffee mug or pick up the phone after checking in with my body. So that part is reinforcing. I'm reminded that that whatever this body and mind is, it's extending out and connected to the rest of the universe. That was my experience, you know, feeling that column of energy reaching up to the airplane above Jokoji was that my experience is connected to the, you know, the people that had just, you know, been told, we are now descending into San Jose Airport. Please buckle your seatbelts. I think maybe Catherine should have told me that first lecture. Buckle your seatbelts, everybody out there. This is a ride you're going to remember for the rest of your life. At the hospital, at the emergency room, Monday afternoon. They were very good. They were very nice. And within the first half hour of Catherine being there, there were six people in the waiting room all waiting. You know, in the emergency room, you can only come in one or two at a time. And they kept saying there were other people. And my response to these very nice nurses and these very nice doctors was, she's a famous Zen teacher. I wanted them to know that there was more people were coming, and actually, they finally moved us all out of the waiting area into the emergency room proper, where they have a family waiting room for difficult cases, for hard cases. And I'd be like, we were the hard cases. But I kept telling them, she's famous. And one of the things that made her famous was being part of this book, Being Bodies, Buddhist Women on the Paradox of Embodiment. And it came out in 97. This is one of the things that Catherine said. And lo and behold, Catherine said it to the Sangha, and she wrote it down and submitted it for this book. A student recently said to me, "Now I understand why it's so important to sit still and not move. When you move, you don't find out what you are moving away from. When you sit still, you can experience what you want to move away from." I thought this was pretty good. It sums up my personal practice of going to the body for answers when I do not understand what is arising in my life. It sounds obvious. When something arises in the body, you would naturally go to the body to inquire about it. Yet I have found that most of us do not know how to listen to our bodies. Long ago, we turned off the voice of the body. The body obediently went silent as we agreed not to notice our emotional or feeling life. Although our bodies continue to hold in silence what was stuffed, there comes a time when the body finally needs to speak out in its own voice to catch our attention. In my own experience, that speaking out has happened in practice through physical symptoms that could no longer be ignored. And the response that seems to work is to sit still or to lie still and coax out what I have long excluded from awareness. This deep listening arises only through sitting still with patience. It arises from bringing attention to the body without expectation, as one might attend a friend who is ill as a kind of servant to the body. She finishes up. This deep listening takes sincere effort. Sometimes my stamina runs out. Sometimes the voice is so buried I despair of getting through to it. As I write this, I imagine I am digging a tunnel with my bare hands, not knowing how deep is the dirt I must dig through, or whether my hands will be strong enough to do it. It takes patience, stamina, a willingness to find nothing, to listen acutely with the ear of intuition, the ear of concentration. Is that Avalokiteshvara listening? In my experience, this recognition of the buried self is essential to the eventual release of emotional patterns that are no longer helpful. This is also a discussion of change in our life. I just wanted to say two more things. A few weeks ago, I gave the lecture and I talked about the koan. Dao Wu and a monk make a condolence call. I put a little spin on it, but that's case 55, I believe, in the Blue Cliff Record, where Dao Wu and his Jisha go visit a family where someone has died, and they get there, and the young monk knocks. Kokyo was referencing this yesterday. Knocks on the coffin and asks Dao Wu, alive or dead? Alive or dead? And Dao Wu says, I won't say. And this goes on actually quite a while until the monk, you know, actually pops Dao Wu. And Dao Wu still says, I won't say. Dao Wu dies ultimately, and the same student who's kept practicing asks his next teacher, alive or dead? And the next teacher says, I won't say. And the student has immediate realization. Even in my discussion 2 weeks ago, I focused on that paradox, the poles of being alive or dead. I think that's what draws us in. What's the answer going to be? Is he alive or is he dead? I've really shifted into the teachers not saying. And that's of course what we heard this week from Catherine. We heard that voice of no speech give us the answer to that koan. She solved that koan for us. very clearly with her speech that was no speech. And as I continue to study that koan, I'm going to move my attention over there, because I've had that experience now. I didn't figure that koan out. I can't say I figured it out, but Catherine, I've had the experience of hearing Catherine explain that koan to me with, I won't say, I will show you. And it's done with the body and the breath, her body and breath, and how that experience with her has resonated with all of our bodies and breath. We have listened to our bodies and breath along with Catherine and received that teaching. Kathy Toldy had picked out a poem to read yesterday and forgot the book here. And I'm gonna steal that opportunity from Kathy. So when she gives her talk in 2 weeks and reads this, I want you to be amazed. Practice being amazed at how great this poem is. And because I'm going to steal her thunder with this smaller group. And as Kathy said, we heard most of this book, you know, read to us by Catherine at the end of talks, mainly at Jikoji, you know, talk after talk. This one is White Flowers. Last night in the fields, I lay down in the darkness to think about death, but instead I fell asleep, as if in a vast and sloping room filled with those white flowers that open all summer, sticky and untidy, in the warm fields. When I woke, the morning light was just slipping in front of the stars, and I was covered with blossoms. I don't know how it happened. I don't know if my body went diving down under the sugary vines in some sleep-sharpened affinity with the depths, or whether that green energy rose like a wave and curled over me, claiming me in its husky arms. I pushed them away, but I didn't rise. Never in my life had I felt so plush or so slippery or so resplendently empty. Never in my life had I felt myself so near that porous line where my body was done with, and the roots and the stems and the flowers began. So, thank you for inviting me to share my experiences with, my first experiences with Catherine. And they're, like I say, they're so up on the surface, and maybe other people have things to say. We've got plenty of time.
Do you feel like there was some evolution or change through those early years of Catherine's teaching over those 20 years that she, as the Sangha grew and as her understanding deepened, did you feel like her teaching changed or not?
Well, she always, with every class, she always had a sheaf of handouts that were from studying with Suzuki and Baker Roshi. You know, they, in those days, they were typed out and mimeographed. And of course, then she would go to Kinko's. We had lots of papers from her on that old. You know, it was computer era when I, almost computer era when I came. So, but so there was always some old teachings from Suzuki and Baker Roshi, and then you know, as you know, there was, you know, for 2 decades there was only Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and then in the 90s we started getting all these great translations of Buddhist texts, and she was up to date. I mean, she kept close contact with San Francisco. It wasn't like we're far away, and so these classes tended to be around new publications. And it was, she really shared her excitement of, you know, kind of the new material that was available, along with having some of the outlines of the old classes in the 60s and 70s where she was first studying it. And so, high points in kind of the lectures that she gave or the classes, we spent a lot of time on Red Pine's Diamond Sutra, and that was very, very good. The kind of, we did that for about a year, and at the beginning of each class, a student was assigned to because it's repeated over and over again that just in the Diamond Sutra that just reciting a 4-line gatha from the Diamond Sutra is more merit than if there were rubies that were as many as the sands of the Ganges. Would that be merit? Sibutiya, who was the foil, and that's, was that the merit, Sibutiya, a merit? Yes. No, Sibuti. Just reciting 4 lines is more merit than all those rubies. Is more value. So that was the how we did that class. So everybody kind of picked lines that were meaningful to them, and they gave like a 5-minute Dharma talk. We looked at Thich Nhat Hanh's transformation at the base. That was how we got into the Yogacara teachings. We did that for a very long time. And you know, she had some of the old teachings there too, from the 60s and 70s. So she kind of got the buzz of what, she kept in touch with what was happening in the larger Zen community. What's being studied now? Who's teaching what? And if it would interest her, which it frequently did, she'd first start where Suzuki or Baker Roshi first brought it up, and go from there. And we never heard much Nagarjuna. She told me a few times, you know, I can't get, is it the language I can't get into? I just can't get into that so much. And then these last few years, I can't remember what turned her on to the Lotus Sutra, but you know, there she was in her 80s, you know, taking in everything she could on the Lotus Sutra. What's it called when you take a class up at the university for non-credit? She audited a class up at UC with Professor, is it Birnbaum? Raoul Birnbaum, who's connected with the Chan lineage, the Chinese lineage. She took a class up there. She's got lots of books on the Lotus Sutra. It was really unfolded more in the Monterey community. She did that for probably a year and a half, didn't she? Down there, I took her for at least one series.
Yes, it was extended, I think, twice, at least twice.
Yeah.
Scheduled, and well, do you want to continue doing this?
Yeah. So that's how we moved through a lot of literature, and of course, we heard a lot of Dogen. That was our coming back to Dogen. We'd do a series in, you know, the Diamond Sutra, and then we all wanted to come back and do Dogen. So we studied Uji. What were some of the other fascicles that we did? Bendowa. Genjo Koan. We spent a lot of time on Mountains and Rivers. Yes, that's Mountains and Rivers. And preceding that was the sounds of the valley stream, colors of the mountain. What's the title of that? Those we did together. Yes, we did when Branching Streams came out. We spent a lot Suzuki's lectures on the Sandokai. We spent a lot of time on that, and she had lots of literature on that because, of course, she had been in those original lectures, and then it was compiled. Did Ed Brown do that, edit that, or so she had some of the original notes of hers and the mimeograph copies, and then we had the nicely edited and compiled Branching Streams book. So I felt like we were, you know, keeping up to date with how Zen texts were being available to the larger Zen community, and she was a prodigious studier. You know, you could go to her house at any time, and you could see where she had, and she sat on a cushion on her carpet, and had all of her books spread out. So that's how she studied. Steve, do you have any?
Well, I was here before Catherine came, actually. It was just sort of this very sort of survival group of students from Tocantino, and then she arrived on the scene, and the whole place transformed pretty quickly. Not like this, but So the forms that I learned were when the altar was over there. So I am a little confused with the forms being gone, but it's great to learn. But there was something about her very beginning years that there was like this rawness to the teaching. Because she was a new teacher and we were all new as her students, and there was something really deep and powerful about that time. Because we were all just finding our way together. Her as teacher and us as students, and just meeting each other just in a very direct and almost, youthful and not virginal, but
naive,
very naive way. And our sessions of the Dakota were just, like Patrick said, it's amazing. And I had that same feeling, like, yes, we were saving all beings, and it was hard, and, you know, the accommodations were very rustic. We all just piled into a room and slept together, and just like scrambled to make the meals happen. It was sort of like a circus half the time.
Yeah.
Very comical.
We learned how to politely tell the snorers to sleep in the zendo.
Yes.
after the first night, it was clear.
Yeah.
The water, we had no water
once. No water once.
We were carrying things from the well in buckets.
Yeah. And all of that just made the experience so intensely good and deep. And yeah, and Catherine was just there in the middle of it. Just whatever happened, she just kept the teaching, kept the forms, kept us all focused, kept us going back inwards. And we learned so much. We learned so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so many little things. Just what I learned in one day is how Patrick, you know, just how to put a cup down and really pay attention to that. And that is a teaching I have kept my entire 22 years since he taught me. Every night I get up at night and get a drink of water. Every night I put it down. She said, experiment with, you know, how the cup hits your counter. Don't just put it down. Let it roll down gently so you make no noise. And release your hand and pay attention to the whole feeling of that. And it's a great practice after this day. So many little things like that in Oreo. Pay attention to the sound as you take the bowl out of the other bowl. And can you minimize that? Can you really just pay attention to what you're doing? If you're making too much noise, what are you really paying attention to? So, you know, where does the spoon go when you put your plastic bowl down? It should go in, not out, because that's offensive. In Japanese culture, it was just many. So to me, her teaching was like grand and big, and yet also just in the details of everyday life. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, there's lots of Jikoji stories we could tell.
Yeah.
Kind of sliding down the hill with the pots in our hands and the wet mud, snow, you know, it would snow in Jikoji.
It would be beer outside, then we go there, but you're eating grass.
Mm-hmm.
And
we finally gravitated to the 2 5-day sesshins at Jikoji during the end of each practice period, and then 3 weekend sesshins here. That was a schedule that we followed for, that was our liturgical year for, you know, 15 years at least. Like I say, my first sesshin, maybe it was the end of spring, so that would have made sense. But I can remember like July's there when it was really hot. We didn't do too many of those. We switched over to when it was icy cold and wet.
Yeah, which was better.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes one sesshin, there was a group that would go up to sort of set up, and then Monterey, you know, took a longer time to get there, and they would come, you know, by the evening. And there was one sesshin where, you know, it was really wet and stormy, and a group of us got there, but then the trees fell over the roads and people couldn't come through, and so we had to try to signal Monterey to, you know, don't come, you know, you're not going to get through, you're going to get, you know, all the way up, and, you know, they're going to turn you back. And so the Monterey people had to come, you know, the next day or something. Yes.
I'll just share a recent experience that I had with Catherine. Some of us are also here. When Tanya came and did the Jukai for hair, and Catherine came and she was sitting up there on her seat, and just observing, just coming to the ceremony. The ceremony was happening down on the floor. I don't remember how many people were here, but it didn't seem like there were very many people here. Titans coming, Harry's family, but I was just sitting there at one moment looking very ordinary. And what made me think of this was when you said, I won't tell you, I'll show you. That was the teaching. At one point in the ceremony, and I was sitting, I think where Funke was sitting right now, there was some part in the ceremony about bodhisattvas rejoicing and things. And I looked over at her and I saw her sitting back there by herself, and I don't remember if she had her hands in gacho or if she was sitting like this. She was speaking, but no, she wasn't, no words were coming out. Almost like she was in silent prayer by herself, sitting there. And it was a really powerful experience for me to see her doing that, because that was kind of that, you know, I'll show you something. I'll show you, this is what deep appreciation for the Dharma looks like. That's what I felt. It's still a very powerful experience for me. Right now, but it really just hit me, just looking at her doing that, sitting there. So, I'll show you.
Thank you. Well, thank you all. Being a I love to end.